Keegan is so cool. He's the sort of guy I always wanted to be but never got to be. We're having a bromance here. Hi, friends. Just want to say I've really appreciated the way that quite a few people have just come up and wanted to chat with me and not actually to agree with some of the things that I'm saying, but to disagree. And I really welcome that. I applaud that. I think we've got to have rigorous and robust discussion around some of these complex issues. And so I've just really been impressed by that. Have kind of pushed me further. So thanks so much, and may it continue. And by the way, some of you owe me money. From last night in the books that I've been selling, I've written a few books. So I bought some to the LGBTI seminar. So if you do need to give me that money, please do. If you don't, let an earthquake swallow you up. Anyway, what was the one thing from any of the facilitators or contributors or talking heads yesterday? What was the one thing that you just want to take into your future? The one thing from yesterday. You don't want to ever forget it. It's the one thing you've captured for your future. Tell the person next to you. Okay, guys, here we go. That was great. I want to read out a passage from Luke 23. So you might just like to listen. You might like to follow. And so it basically goes like this. So this is the crucifixion scene. Luke 23 and verse 32. And it goes like this. There were two other criminals who were taken with him to be executed. And when they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there with the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. Father, said Jesus, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And the people stood around watching, and the rulers, they hurled abuse at him. He rescued others, they said. Let him try rescuing himself, if he really is the Messiah, God's chosen one. And the soldiers added their taunts, coming up and offering him cheap wine. If you're the king of the Jews, they said, rescue yourself. And the charge was written above him, this is the king of the Jews. And one of the bad characters who was hanging there began to insult Jesus. Aren't you the Messiah? He said, rescue yourself and us too. But the other one on the other side told him off. Don't you fear God? He said, you're sharing the same fate that he is. In our case, it's fair enough. We're getting exactly what we asked for. But this fellow, he hasn't done anything out of order. Jesus, he went on, remember me when you finally become king. And I'm telling you the truth, replied Jesus. You'll be with me in paradise to this very day. And by that time of the sixth hour, darkness came over the land. The sunlight vanished until the ninth hour, and the veil of the temple was ripped down the middle. Then Jesus shouted out at the top of his voice, here's my spirit, Father. You can take care of it now. And with that, he died. And the centurion saw what happened and praised God. This fellow, he said, really was in the right. Okay. So if you were in my shoes, what would you talk about from that passage? What grabbed you? What caught your attention? Was there a word, a phrase, a sentence, a theme? What was it that kind of caught your eye? Turn to the person next to you and chat about that. Okay, friends, here we go. When I read that passage, the thing that really struck me initially was what you guys have just done. In other words, here is Jesus, in a nightmare scenario, and he's on the cross, and yet he's having this casual conversation with the person beside him. Did you pick that up? It's like, you know, there are two people beside Jesus and they're having this conversation. And when I read that initially, I thought that, you know, the cross can't be all that bad. I mean, if people are just able to have this kind of casual conversation with the person beside you while they're being, you know, impaled, as it were, on the cross, the cross can't be that bad. But here we need to discover a little bit about first century AD and what this cross life, if you like, was like. Because the whole idea with being impaled on a cross was to keep you as alive as long as possible. So when you had people on a cross, these people were half alive and half dead. I mean, the Romans, they didn't want to do just a simple hanging. So it was over and done with within a matter of, you know, seconds, as it were. They just didn't want to, you know, cut and slice your life away. The whole idea with the cross was that you'd be kept alive as long as possible. Why? Because, you see, they wanted to prolong certain things. So a person would be on the cross, half alive, half dead, and they would be covered in blood and flies. And then they would be nibbled at by rats. And they would be pecked at by crows. And all the while, just below them, would be family and friends, absolutely powerless, not able to do a thing, weeping copious amounts of tears. So the cross was about the most cruelest forms of violence. But it wasn't just about violence. You see, despite what the Christian artists have depicted Jesus as, when a person was crucified on the cross, they were crucified naked. Now, Christian artists have put loincloths and so forth and so on around Jesus's, especially his private parts, in order to add some sort of, you know, reverence to the scene. But when a person was crucified, they were crucified naked. The way Jesus came into the world was the way that Jesus went out of the world, absolutely stark naked. The point being that the crucifixion was not just about violence, it was about shame. And when Jesus was hanging there on that cross with everything to be seen, there were a lot of people mingling almost at high eye level if they were standing. And they could see it all. And the sexual taunting and the shaming that occurred on the cross. Because you see, the cross wasn't just about violence, it was about shame. And you could just imagine Jesus on the cross. And you know, there would be a part of him, everything that was screaming within him, to use his hands to cover that which needed to be covered. But there's no way that that could happen. And so the first point that I want to make this morning is that our founder was shamed. And the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ, Jesus, is the shamed one. And it seems to me, people, that we as churches and we as student life, as a movement, we are to be a movement of the shamed. And a church of the shamed. Because out there in the streets of whatever city you come from, And out there on the campuses of which you belong, there are so many people carrying shame. Yes? So many. So many people where things have been done to them that shouldn't have been done to anybody. And they carry shame. And then there's this other group of people, and they've done things to other people that shouldn't be done to anybody. And they also carry shame. Now, I have a question. What is the first thing that people need or want if they are carrying shame? What is the thing that they want or need? Tell the person next to you. It's amazing how when we have these little chats, do you mind them, by the way? Yeah. When we turn to the person next to you, you like them. But it all dies down at the same time, you know? So I don't know why. Is that a herd instinct? I don't know, but it all dies down. I don't know what friends you came up with in terms of, you know, those who carry shame. Oh, there are so many people who carry shame. And what is the very first thing that they want or need? I don't know where you got to on that. And in a sense, there's no right or wrong answer. But as I've reflected on this, where I've got to is, you know, for example, when someone has had something done to them that shouldn't have been done to anybody, the first thing that they look for is someone who comes to them and says, I've been there and it's been done to me as well. Me too. Yes? Me too. And for those who are the perpetrators, not the victims this time, but the perpetrators, and the perps, they've done things to people that no one should ever do to people. They also desperately want to hear a voice that says to them, oh yeah, I've been there. And I have done things to people that I should never have done. In other words, they want to hear the words, you too. Did you get that? Oh, you too. You've done that. I've done that as well. For other people, it's me too. For other people, it's you too. In other words, the cure for shame is empathy. When people are carrying shame, they just want empathy. Oh yeah, that's been done to me as well. Oh yeah, I've done that as well. The cure for shame is empathy. But here's the thing, people, and I'm getting close to my point. Here's the thing. There are all these people out there who are carrying so much shame. They must cripple their lives. That would be so hard. The last place that they would think of coming to is a church. I mean, the last place that they would cross the threshold of is a church. These people who carry shame, I just don't go there. I couldn't go there. And even arguably the last place that they would go to, especially those that carry shame on the campuses of this country, the last place that they would ever consider going to is your student life group. Now, why is that? Why is it that our very founder was shamed? And yet the very last place that those who carry shame would be to come to a local church or to a student life group. Why is that? Have that conversation now. Go to it. Okay, friends. So I would like some of you to yell out in a big loud voice what you think. Sometimes those that those that carry shame, the last place that they would ever consider coming to is the church, even though our founder was shamed, or a student life group. Give me some of the reasons. Yell them out. Please. Scared of being judged. Give me another one. They have this persona that Christians are perfect. Thank you. Give me another one.
Rejection.
They fear rejection. Good one. Give me another one.
Guilt.
Beg your pardon?
Guilt.
I missed that?
Guilt.
Their guilt?
Yeah,
they don't. Yep. Their guilt. So thus far we've had people from this side of the aisle.
Yeah.
So now we'll go over to the B team. okay, you bright people here. Tell me, give me some others. Christians won't be able to provide empathy. Okay, very good. Okay, so the B team's doing well. give me another one. Thank you, Bob. Is that Bob? Mr. Bob. Okay. We don't talk about our weaknesses. Thank you. Anybody else got one? Oh, so, who said that? Whoa. They feel as though we'll go into rescue mode, become fixers and rescuers. Is that right? Is that what you said? Whoa, you should be over here. Let me share where I have got to on this. I think, and there's no right or wrong answer here, but in my personal reflections, where I've got to here, is that those who carry shame on our campuses, those who carry shame on our streets, two of the reasons that they are most reluctant to cross the threshold of churches and student life groups is one, because of an image that they have of our groups, our churches, and largely I think it's accurate. But secondly, and I'll get to this later, they have a distorted image of God. Now, if I come back to the first, you see, I do think there is an impression out there that people have of our churches and our groups that our groups are posh places for posh people. In other words, our groups, our churches are for the polished and the pretty. In other words, our groups and our churches are for the put-together people. I had to really work on the P's there. So we had the posh, the polished, the proper, the put-together, the pretty, and so on. And I'll tell you this, friends, and I'm not wanting to be unkind, but if you as a sociologist just looked at the people who file into our churches, who file into our groups, they by and large are the polished, the proper, the pretty, the put-together, and the proper. And no wonder the shame they feel. I do not belong amongst that number. But the second reason is a distorted image of God, where I think a lot of people who carry shame, you know, somehow they have this picture of God, who God is bald, and God is large, and God, you know, wears long robes, and God has latex gloves on, and God, you know, in heaven is forever scrubbing the walls of heaven with bleach and disinfectant, In other words, he wants his heaven to be spick and span. You know, he just can't abide dirt. He can't abide filth. I mean, if God was an eater and he had leftovers and he had a fridge, he would have Tupperware. And he would have his food nicely organized in his fridge. And you see, if God wore shoes and he had a wardrobe, oh, he would have a shoe organizer. And he would have all his shoes in their proper place. And if God had a garage, oh, that garage would be spick and span. It would just be, you know, no dirt, no filth, no grubby little corner. And they have this idea of God as Mr. Clean. And you know, I've given my life to telling people that God is righteous, yes, but he doesn't fit that Mr. Clean caricature. Because when you look at the scene of the cross, you see a God who does filth. You see a God who does dirt. You see a God who does the grubby little corners of the planet. You see a God who immerses himself in filth. You see a God who absorbed all the dark stains of humanity and brought them into his very self, such that those fissures of stain and filth and dirt do dirt. You know, I heard this, it's public knowledge. I read the story of a guy, and his name is Richard. And Richard, he belonged to a local gym. And you know, Richard, he was anti-Semitic, he was sexist, he was xenophobic, he was racist, he was, you know, kind of homophobic. He was just foul. And all this kind of noxious, obnoxious kind of filth would come out of his mouth while he was in the gym. And there was this lady, and she was a professor at a local college, and she started up a kind of a protest against this guy called Richard to get this bloke expelled from the gym because of who he was and what he said. And she was successful, and he got expelled from that particular club. And when I read of that story, I thought, he would be welcome at our club. Surely. An ungodly person like that would be so welcome, surely, in our church and in our student life group. Is that right? In other words, we could say to Richard, we welcome you as you are. We don't accept you as you are, but we welcome you as you are. This is a club for the ungodly. Because our God can do dirt. Our God can do filth. Our God can do Richard. Our God is a God who's been shamed, and he can do shame. Is that right? People?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So I got to land this. And where I want to land it, it goes like this. And some of you may not like this, but that's your problem. I said yesterday that our God is king. And what I'm wanting to say this morning is that our God is a naked king. He's a naked king. And what this naked king is asking of you is that you get naked with him. Now, I say that advisably. In other words, it says in Matthew's gospel that you are to go into your bedroom and close the bedroom door. It actually says this. And then you are to take off all your false IDs, your false profiles. And you are to get naked with the naked king. And you are to come before Jesus. And you are to say, I am bitchy and bossy. And I am masturbator. And I am greedy. And I am ambitious. And I am hateful of my parents. And I am secretly abusing substances. And I am privately gambling. And I am watching screens and watching porn. And I am doing things with other people's bodies that I shouldn't be. And I am overly ambitious. And I am bully who walks all over people. And I am gossiper and I talk too much about other people. And I am. Tell you what Jesus will say. He will walk right close because he's as close as God can be with you. And he will say, are you ready? And you'll say, ready for what? And he'll say, me. He'll say, I am here. There is this mentality even in groups like this morning. And somehow you think that Jesus stands at some distance from you and sort of teaches you how to get clean. And when you are all clean, then he comes close. That's not how it is. Even when you stand in your filth, he comes and stands in the filth with you and says, I am here. It's so good. It's so great. But the second thing that I wanted to share, and I felt to do it prophetically with you as a group, is that you guys have got to start getting naked with each other. Okay, you can shut up now. And you know what I mean. It's like the big challenge, prophetic challenge for you guys in your student life groups is to get kind of, you know, to let other people in, to be absolutely transparent with each other. To let other people see you as you are and where you don't do the cover-up. But you get involved in each other's filth. You get involved in each other's shame. You get involved in each other's, you know, sin sickness. You get involved in the dirty, grubby little corners that a lot of people in this room have. And you do that work together. And you learn how to do messy, messy, messy stuff together like this, such that you learn how to do it safely. You learn how to do it confidentially. You learn how to do this stuff in a people-honoring manner. And I'll tell you what will happen. When you begin to do the transparency and the nakedness with each other, and you learn how to do it as student life, God in heaven will notice. And what God in heaven will do is he will start sending you the shamed on your campuses. Because student life has a wonderful reputation of going to people. But there are a lot of people out there who God is desperately wanting to send to you, without you even going to them. But he will only send them to you if you guys can do shame with each other. Where you become the kind of culture with each other, you share all, and that's all, with each other. And you learn how to do it safely, confidentially, and in a people-honoring manner. And when you become that kind of outfit, he will begin to send people to you. Did you get that? Such that they, the shamed, will become a part of a community of the washed. This is the best thing in town. So I've got to wrap it up, and I thought we would get all naked with each other this morning. So, there are staff members of student life here. I could ask you to all stand, but I won't. And the particular sin that afflicts staff members of student life, the particular sin, it's called noble cause sin. And noble cause sin is where you get a staffie, and, you know, because they're a staff member and they're sacrificing and they're full on and they're to the max and they're over the top and they're doing this and that, you know, they think that they can indulge in a grubby little corner somewhere. And in a sense, God will turn a blind eye. God will turn away because, oh, you're doing so much good. You know, you're in the noble cause. So you feel as though God will kind of turn a blind eye to this thing that's distracting you and dominating you. And there are staff members in this room, and that is you. It's called noble cause sin. And then there's a whole lot of other of you here, and you belong to the 9 out of 10 club. And as these nice Christians, you know, you kind of look at your life, and in the 9 areas, you say to God, God, your will be done. But there is that 10th area where you say to yourselves, and my will be done. And then you're thinking and you're saying, oh, Mick, you're so harsh. Don't come back again. And you're thinking, Mick, surely 9 out of 10 is okay. But what happens if that 10th area is the area that will kill you? What if it's that 10th area that will damage some of the most important relationships in your life? What if it's that 10th area that will diminish you? There's a lot of you in the 9 out of 10 club. And then there's the third and last type of sin. You know what it's called? It's called signature sin, your signature sin. And this is as you get older. So let me speak as an older person. In my 20s, my signature sin was arrogance. I actually thought I was different and better than most. Honestly. People saw it in me. That was in my 20s. That was my signature sin. In my 30s, my signature sin was impurity. I told you the other night that we were in the Philippines, and whilst in the Philippines, you know, it was pretty hard living in the slums, and you know, when you go through a really hard time, you're most tempted to sin because you're looking for comfort. And in my 30s, there I was in the Manila, and there was this beautiful, sexy Filipina. And she was hitting on me. And I could understand that. And there was one particular night, because we lived close quarters with each other. You know, you could look through the plywood and you see, you know. And she showed me her wares. And I thought, not bad. So I said to myself, consciously, if she comes knocking at my door tonight, I will open the door to her. Because Ruby and the kids were away at that time. So there I was, all alone, needing comfort. And there was a knock at the door at 12 o'clock at night. So I went to the door hoping that it was her. And I opened the door and there was a bloke. Another disappointment in life, you know. So I slammed the door in his face, but I knew I had crossed a line. Now don't get me wrong, my fingers had not touched her physical flesh, but my fingers had walked all over her. And I struggled with impurity. That was my signature sin in my 30s. Probably a lot of you can't relate to this. That was a joke. In my 40s, my signature sin was anger. Can you relate to that? I was so full of anger in my 40s that I was involved in a road rage episode and charged. So here I was as a Christian pastor and a Christian leader, and a truck came by from the opposite direction. And a rope at the back of the truck came loose and swung around and hit the front windshield, such that glass and wind and rain raced in and smothered me and the three kids in the back seat. And I was just so full of anger in those days that just an episode like that, it just filled me with rage. So I followed the truck. And when I thought I could get ahead of the truck, I did. And when I got ahead of the truck, I put the brakes on to get the truck to stop in mid-traffic. I mean, what the heck? But that's what I did. And, you know, caused mayhem and madness on the road, such that a policeman came and charged me with dangerous driving. I was so full of anger. That was my signature sin. And eventually they dropped the charges, largely because all good criminals, I shot off to Australia. In my 50s, people, I hope I'm not boring you, but in my 50s, my signature sin was just deep grief over how I should have given more time to my own kids. And so I went to each and every one of them and apologized for the lousy father I had been at times, not all the time. And now I'm in my 60s and I have a new signature sin. And I share this with some discomfort because, you know, no one likes to be misunderstood when you share honestly. Is that right? But my signature sin here is, you see, I've always had this kind of complex relationship with alcohol. Anybody else in the room? I thought we were going to get naked with each other. And when I became a Christ, I was brought up in a home, you know, where, you know, it was common to have a glass of wine and a glass of beer at dinner table and all that kind of stuff. It was just so norm. That was the huge. And then when I became a Christ follower, Christ follower is not too bad. I went to Jesus and I said, Master, you are the King. Just say the word and I will do it in terms of alcohol. I mean, that's what it is to be a subject to the King. He says, Mick, I want you to go dry. Have a dry season. So I had a dry season for 15 years. Way too long. But I had a dry season for 15 years. And then I go back to the Master and I say, Master, where are we up to now on this issue? And he says, okay, you can have a wet season. So it lasted for 5 years. And I had a wet season. And then I felt that Jesus was asking me to have another dry season. And that lasted, you know, another, 15 to 20 years. And then just recently, about 4 years ago, the Master, gave me permission to enjoy the enjoyable. For most of my life, I've said no to 1,000 things to say yes to 1 or 2 things. That's discipleship. But it was a few years back where he says, Mick, I want to give you a season where you can have a dream home and you can enjoy the enjoyable because you've given up that season in decades and decades before. And so now I'm in this season of enjoying the enjoyable. And I do have an addictive side to me. Anybody else in the room? Not yet naked with each other. And so, but I'll be honest and say that, you know, now in my 60s, my signature sin is where at times, you know, just one drink too many. And we all know when we've crossed that line. So I've just been naked with you. And I'm now going to invite us to be naked. Because if we learn how to do nakedness together in front of our naked King, and we learn to do this well and courageously, He will send the shame to us that they may become washed. Who here is carrying something? Who here is a slanderer? Who here has not yet learned how to get control over the genitalia in your life and you are saying, I am masturbator too often. I am fantasizer. Who here has an addiction issue around substances? Who here is a bully? Who here is a bitch? Who here is a liar? Who here is hateful, resentful towards parents? Who here is, I am like the priest who walked by the poor and you've got a cold heart. You are indifferent towards those in need. Who here lacks empathy? I am cold. Who here is gossiper? Who here is struggling with something? Stand up. Whoa. So we're going to do two things to finish. If yesterday with the King, with our hands, we had hands to the side, in this sort of posture, today our hands are going to be turned up like this in surrender. Almost in absolute nakedness to our naked King. We're going to do this first. Jesus, our naked King, the one who still has scars on his body in heaven, the one who was shamed. We come to you this morning as also the shamed ones. We are here, King, and you are here, and we are here together. Oh, your kindness. Oh, your kindness at this moment. We read, Lord, that your kindness leads to repentance. Oh, your mercy. Oh, your companionship. Oh, your forgiveness. Oh, your pardon. Oh, your cleansing. Oh, your embrace. Oh, you. Thank you for you. Thank you that you can jump into our dirt. You are the God of the dirt. Oh, thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. Hallelujah. Now, I want you to turn to someone next to you and tell them about your shame and your dirt. Go to it.